I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This week, documentary filmmaker William Gazecki releases Future by Design, a film about the life and work of utopian architect Jacques Fresco. On the show today, I talk with Fresco about his social engineering ideas and play a trailer from the film. Jacques Fresco was born in 1916, which means he is now 90 years old, if you're doing the math. In the 40s, he started a plastics company and then moved on to aerospace research, architecture, automobile engineering, methods to view 3D video projections, and 3D displays of x-rays for medical purposes. In the 1940s, Fresco was drawn to the technocracy movement. Growing out of disillusionment with Soviet communism, fascism, and liberal democracy, and faith in scientific planning as the solution to social problems among many intellectuals and activists, the technocrats had emerged in the 1930s in the U.S. and Europe. The technocrats argued that a planned, stable-state, non-market economy is both the answer to preserving ecosystems and resources and to providing universal abundance. For instance, they have advocated for the more intensive automation of industry in order to free humans for leisure. The movement is represented today by Technocracy Incorporated, which can be found at technocracy.org. Fresco left the technocrats in the 1960s to start his own organization based on his ideas for utopian architecture and socio-cybernearing. In the late 1960s and 70s, he wrote a number of books exploring the concepts of socio-cybernearing and their relationship to urban design and psychological theory. In the 1980s, this morphed into the Venus Project, which can be found at thevenusproject.com, not venusproject.com, which is a Muslim site. The Venus Project is situated on a 25-acre research facility in Venus, Florida, where Fresco lives and builds structures based on his materials and architectural research. That work can be found in the books The Venus Project, The Redesign of a Culture, The World Will Be One, and the 2002 work, The Best That Money Can't Buy, Beyond Politics, Poverty, and War. Like the technocrats, Fresco promotes a post-market resource-based economy, sustainable design, eliminating the nation-state, and the liberation of scientific and technological research. To find out more about the film on Fresco, Future by Design, go to fbdthemovie.com, fbdthemovie.com. You can sign up there for information about its screenings and availability on DVD. The work on Fresco and the Venus Project can be found at thevenusproject.com. I spoke with Jacques Fresco in the spring of 2006. Tell us a little bit about the Venus Project.
Well, Venus Project is a proposal for a global society based on resources, not monetary systems. When a few nations control most of the Earth's resources, you're going to have trouble. No system will work. Politics cannot provide the answers for the type of problems we're about to face from the present to the near future. The problems are technical in nature, not political.
Well, that's a pretty controversial assumption. Don't you think that there's a need for political reform as well as new designs and technologies?
Politics will not serve. In other words, throughout history, people have tried to make the world a better place. There's been more wars than ever. Nuclear devices exist throughout the world, so it doesn't seem to me that any political system can solve or even cope with the problems up ahead.
In the Venus Project design, which is a utopian design that you have there on the web, and a number of movies and materials that are available for that, what is the decision-making mechanism about the allocation of things and how things are run in that society?
Well, first of all, it cannot be introduced unless we're trying to make a motion picture, a major motion picture called And the World Will Be One. That motion picture depicts the kind of society that I'm talking about and the necessary procedures to attain that society. Now, what I'm about to say may be unpleasant to some people, but it will not come about through reason or sitting down discussing things. The system will have to break down first. During the last depression, when people lost their homes, their jobs, the bank accounts failed, then a batch of new organizations sprung up. There were old organizations, communism, socialism, Mankind United, technocracy, all kinds of new organizations grew under those conditions. We are not in a state yet that will bring about the question as to how to manage a global society. It would take an economic breakdown first. But prior to the breakdown, we would like to finish this motion picture, get it out there, called And the World Will Be One. That motion picture will prepare people for a possible alternative. Although there are many liberals on the air today talking about the shortcomings of our society, and I mean very famous people, but they offer no alternatives. They merely point out the shortcomings. The whole idea is ridiculous of electing ethical people into government. If you succeeded in electing the most ethical people on earth, if we ran out of resources, they'd be lying, cheating, stealing, the same catalog of problems. So it's not ethical people that we need. It's the application of science and technology to the social system, the methods of science.
What is the resource-based economic model that you argue for?
Okay. If you found yourself on an island and you say you were stranded there with $10 million, there's no water, no topsoil, no fish. You have nothing. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So the real value of a nation is not its money or its ethical people. It's the resources. If you don't have resources, you can't operate.
That makes sense.
So this is the basis of a resource-based economy. Money does not represent anything. It's an agreement amongst people as a medium of exchange for work. The real answers lie in resources. So through science and technology, we can create all the resources we need if we manage the Earth in accordance with its carrying capacity. Do you follow that?
Sure.
If your population exceeds the carrying capacity, no matter what kind of laws you make or treaties you sign, they will be broken or violated. So man sits back making a bunch of laws that have nothing whatsoever to do with the carrying capacity of the Earth. And so all the meetings, the UN, all the liberals out there that are talking about decency and ethics in government, you cannot have decency and ethics in government when there's social stratification. When some people earn minimum wage, you cannot have... We keep talking about returning to the old democracy. There's never been a democracy. As long as you have chain gangs and minimum wage, you're not going to have a society whereby people can make intelligent choices because they're not intelligently informed. Our schools are more or less propaganda rather than sources of good and applicable information.
So in your ideal society, it would be a global government. And
it must be global.
And it would be a post-market society. You wouldn't have markets.
We wouldn't have money either.
Yeah.
In other words, you would get your goods and services in a manner similar to the public library. Prior to the public library, people protested and said, you can't give books to people, make them available without charge. It would interfere with the book publishing industry. Well, when the library was finally put in, people read more and bought more books. So we want to build a system like the public library where anyone can access a camera, a bicycle, or anything they need. It is much cheaper to make things available to people than build prisons and police.
Do you think that nanotechnology may hold, molecular manufacturing may hold some of the superabundance that would be necessary for this kind of a society?
Well, what you're saying is if we can produce an abundance of goods and services, it would be impractical to set a price tag on things. It's just scarcity that sets a price tag on things. In other words, we used to get all the water we needed. No one ever stole any water. But today, I think you have to pay about $1 for a glass of water. Well, this is ridiculous. That's because of scarcity. And as long as the system maintains scarcity and plows under overproduction and pays farmers not to produce, and goods are designed to wear out and break down, you're not going to have a sane society. No matter how many books you read, no matter how many conferences are held on the production and design of an intelligent government, we don't have an intelligent government. Intelligent government does not exist, nor can it exist, in a monetary system. In other words, in Germany, all the technicians and scientists, not all, but most of them, fell in line with the Nazi point of view. This happens in all countries. Propaganda is used, and there's really no such thing as a scientist. There are people that are scientific in chemistry or physics or botany, but they're not joined together as a coercive force that is responsible for, that can be responsible for maintaining dynamic equilibrium on Earth.
So your notion is similar to the old technocratic notion that...
No, the technocrats had designed things for America only. And when I looked into technocracy, what they did is I noticed there weren't any Orientals or blacks in the organization. And I questioned that. And they said Howard Scott, anyway, who was the chief engineer, said that, well, let them start their own section. Besides, the Oriental mind is different. I resigned from the organization because any system that excludes anyone has no basis for social operation, cannot work. So we feel that all people can achieve great technical things, that we owe so much to all people all over the world, that no nation can exist without respecting those contributions made by all people. So the Venus Project has no government. Let me put it in other terms. If you can picture, say, a Department of Agriculture with its electrical tentacles into the soil, so if the water table drops, that system pumps water into the irrigation areas. If the nutrients change, it pumps nutrients out there. You don't need a group of people in Washington making decisions based on nothing in particular but traditions and false values and artificialities. This is what you have now all over the world. So you don't have any basis for building a better world today except a lot of verbal behavior.
What's the relationship of the Future by Design project to the Venus Project idea?
Well, the Future by Design is a documentary that will be released very soon. It's just been completed by William Gazecki. And the documentary will be released perhaps in the next 2 months or so. And that'll give you a pretty good picture. But if you want any real detailed information on the Venus Project, you can go www.thevenusproject.com.
Well, that's a great introduction to your ideas. I really appreciate
it. Well, that's a pretty good introduction, but a more comprehensive one is a book that we produce called The Best That Money Can't Buy, Beyond Politics, Poverty, and War. Now, that book depicts the kind of society I'm talking about and its method of implementation.
Excellent. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
This is the trailer for the movie The Future by Design.
I was always interested in the future, as far back as I can remember. I drew airplanes and cities of the future and underwater cities and floating cities.
Now, this looks like some sort of submerged stadium with something.
We might build circular cities in the sea. Most of the apartment houses will open out into the sea. You can observe marine life and fish swimming by. There'll be no zoos, no seaquariums. Everything will be observed in natural conditions. There will be boating, scuba diving, recreation, and universities built in the sea.
These drawings all made by you?
Yes.
Jacques Fresco is a self-taught scientist, architect, and inventor. For his entire life, he has been deeply committed to investigation, insight, and innovation. A prolific creator and builder, Jacques has been redesigning our entire culture for most of his life. Jacques Fresco doesn't want to just talk about what today will be like tomorrow. He has a plan to build an entire new world from the ground up.
So the models that I make are all transitional, and many of them are only conceptual. They're not necessarily what the future might look like. They're only, well, let's say they're extrapolations of taking the present and extrapolating forward. But we can't go too far forward because we don't know what new things will come into being.
Are you betting that people will not declare war on each other so that you can get at building all of this?
Well, we don't have much choice. We're going to destroy each other or we're going to make it.
When you try to think about the future, remember this. The process with which you think about things is based upon indoctrination, what you're given by your society. So your range of thought is limited by the dominant values of your society. We talk about civilization as though it's a static state, and there are no civilized people yet. It's a process that's constantly going on. As long as you have war, police, prisons, crime, you're in the early stages of civilization, what they call civilization. All the marvels and wonders of technology can amount to nothing unless it elevates humans to their highest potential. This is the aim of the future by design.
Again, information about the movie Future by Design can be found at fbdthemovie.com, and information about the Venus Project can be found at thevenusproject.com. This is an essay by Jaime Cassio, an IEET fellow. He published this essay in Futurismic, which is at futurismic.com. The essay is titled, What Does It Mean to Be an Ethical Futurist? I don't mean just the basics of being an ethical human being, or even the particular ethical guidelines one might see for any kind of professional, disclosure of conflicts of interest, for example, or honesty in transactions. I mean the ethical conventions that would be essentially unique to futurists. What kinds of rules should apply to those of us who make a living or a life's goal out of thinking about what may come? Futurists, including scenario planners, trend spotters, foresight specialists, paradigm engineers, and the myriad other labels that we use, have something of an odd professional role. We're akin to reporters, but we're reporters of events that have not yet happened and may not happen. We're analysts, but analysts of possibilities, not histories. We're science fiction storytellers, but the stories we tell are less for entertainment than for enlightenment. And much to our surprise, we may be much more influential than we expect. It's not that no futurists have considered ethical issues before. Foresight professionals regularly grapple with the question of what kinds of ethical guidelines should govern futurism in mailing lists, organizational debates, and academic papers. But, to my surprise, neither of the two main professional organizations for futurists, the World Future Society and the Association of Professional Futurists, have any lists, documents, or debates on the subject available to the public. This doesn't mean that futurists are inclined to behave unethically or amorally, but simply that there seems to be no overarching set of principles for the field, at least none open to the broader community in which futurists act. As I gave this some thought, it struck me that futurists are not alone in thinking about tomorrow professionally. Most business consultant types also concern themselves with what may come, with the results of corporate decisions and organizational choices. But the difference between that sort of business consulting and foresight consulting comes down to the difference between outcomes and consequences. Outcomes are the immediate or long-term results of actions. Consequences are how those actions connect to the choices and actions of others and to the larger context of society, the environment, and the future itself. As I see it then, where business professionals are responsible to the client and their various stakeholders, foresight professionals are responsible to the future. Here's what I think that means. It means that the first duty of an ethical futurist is to act in the interest of the stakeholders yet to come, those who would suffer harm in the future from choices made in the present. This harm could come, in my view, in the form of fewer options or possibilities for development, less ecological diversity and environmental stability, and greater risks to the health and well-being of people and other species on the planet. futurists as those people who have chosen to become navigators for society, responsible for watching the path ahead, have a particular responsibility for safeguarding that path and to ensure that the people making strategic choices about actions and policies have the opportunity to do so wisely. From this, I would argue for the following set of ethical principles. An ethical futurist has a responsibility not to let the desires of a client or audience or collaborator for a particular outcome blind him or her to the consequences of that goal, and will always inform the client of both the risks and the rewards. An ethical futurist has the responsibility to understand as fully as possible the range of issues and systems connected to the question under consideration to avoid missing critical potential consequences. An ethical futurist has the responsibility to acknowledge and make her or his client, audience, collaborators cognizant of the uncertainty of forecasts and to explain why some outcomes and consequences are more or less likely than others. An ethical futurist has the responsibility to offer unbiased analysis based on an honest appraisal of sources with as much transparency of process as possible. An ethical futurist has the responsibility to recognize the difference between short-term results and long-term processes, and to always keep an eye on the more distant possibilities. Futurists perform a quirky but necessary task in modern society. We function as the long-range scanners for a species evolved to pay close attention to short-range horizons. Some neurophysiologists argue that this comes from the simple act of throwing an object to hit a moving target. Chimpanzees and bonobos, even with DNA 98% identical to our own, are simply unable to do so, while most humans can, at least with a bit of experience. It turns out that the same cognitive structures that let us understand where a moving target will be also help us recognize the broader relationship between action and result, or more simply, how if becomes then. I'm not sure how many futurists recognize the weight of responsibility that rests on their shoulders. This is an occupation in which attention deficit disorder is something of a professional requirement. But when we do our jobs well, we can play a pretty damn important role in shaping the course of human history. It's incumbent upon us, then, to do our jobs with a sense of purpose and ethics. That was the essay, What Does It Mean to Be an Ethical Futurist? By Jaime Cassio, an IEET fellow, published in Futurismic on November 6, 2006. Like many Americans, I feel since the election of November 7th that brought the Democrats into control of the U.S. House and Senate, a lifting of a very heavy weight, a passing away of very dark clouds that had clouded the prospects for an American future that I wanted to live in, and also an opening for new techno-progressive ideas to have influence on U.S. policy and policy worldwide. The Bush administration and the Republican control of Congress had been a real block to the progress or prospects for techno-progressive ideas. With the power of the religious right, Pax America, militarism and unilateralism, and direct control of regulatory policy by corporations, pushing a very regressive agenda. But with this change of November 7th, 2006, and the end of anti-science policies, which were designed by corporate lobbyists and religious zealots and forced on federal regulatory and science agencies through the Bush administration, we are looking forward to immediate prospects for progress with things such as stem cell research and climate science, and more oversight over the politicization of science by Republicans in Washington, D.C. I think there's also a new opening internationally for multilateral solutions and globalism to solve global environmental, health, and security threats. The Progressive Caucus has entered into the U.S. House as now the largest caucus within the Democratic Party, gaining half a dozen new members in this election. And one member of that caucus has moved on to be a part of the U.S. Senate. Two members, actually, but one, Bernie Sanders, is an open socialist independent, the first socialist to enter the U.S. Senate. One of the prospects for techno-progressive policy that we might see coming out of, for instance, the progressive side of the Democratic Party, the Progressive Caucus, is a new push for energy independence policies that rely more on industrial and urban policy rather than on hand-waving at the free market's influence and hand-waving at ethanol and nuclear energy. We might see, for instance, progress towards the very ambitious goals of the green and labor-crafted Apollo Alliance, which we've profiled on this show in the past, a set of multi-billion dollar efforts to redesign cities and industry and transportation and so forth to make the United States more energy independent. I think we also may see more progress towards the kinds of goals outlined by the new longevity dividend campaign to fund longevity research as a solution to the growing old age dependence ratio that threatens to undermine the fiscal solvency of the social welfare state in Europe and the United States. Of course, a recent research that shows that resveratrol, a key ingredient in red wine, dramatically extends the life expectancy of mammals, dramatically supports that kind of research. So I believe the time is right for a techno-progressive voice in global politics and policy. The IET, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, was founded in 2004 out of the World Transhumanist Association, which had a strong overlap with the IET. But the IET always had a more progressive slant, emphasizing the importance of safety and equity, and had many concerns beyond the right to human enhancement, which was the signal issue for transhumanism, is the signal issue for transhumanism, to include things such as global ecological sustainability, global governance, and ensuring the economic security of all people through a guaranteed basic income in an era of automation and globalization. The IET is now expanding in Europe, where we're considering incorporating a second branch, and has many prospects for growth, but I've been unable to explore them since 2004 because I've also been the executive director during that time of the World Transhumanist Association. I feel that the time is right for me to focus more energy on the IET, so I have resigned as the WTA executive director to devote myself to building the IET as a techno-progressive voice and to secure funding for IET projects, to organize IET conferences, to write IET-related books, such as the book I'm working on now, Cyborg Buddha, which is about the moral implications of neurotechnologies, and also Cyborg Life, which is a collaboration I'm working on with Peter Houghton, exploring the experiences and needs of today's cyborgs, people living with artificial organs and implants, and suffering the medical, economic, and psychological traumas of having machine parts. Change Surfer Radio was the first step that led me to eventually get involved with and become the executive director of the World Transhumanist Association and then of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And I look forward to developing Change Surfer Radio as a form of public intellectual work, as a voice for the emerging techno-progressive viewpoint. Thank you for your support, and keep listening for more sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic futurism. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.